this paper, and this is work done with a Caltech graduate student, Lottie Ackerman. I managed to tie Sean Carroll down for a couple of days at Caltech so we could work together. So also with Sean Carroll. And the problem I should get a number, right? It's actually probably published by now, but I'll give you the number. And it's a pretty simple thing that we looked at and pretty simple to explain, so it makes a good Blackboard talk, and that's why I decided to do it instead of this way, flashing up transparencies. Blackboard slows you down so the audience has a chance to understand something. It's always dangerous when the audience has a chance to understand something, but I'll take the risk. So the question we tried to address was the following. So we know, in the physics that you learn as an undergraduate, one of the cherished principles is rotational invariance. And of course, one of the consequences of that is conservation of angular momentum. However, it is possible that rotational invariance is spontaneously broken. Indeed, if you have a magnet and the spins line up, that's spontaneous breaking of the rotational invariance. Even though rotational invariance is not broken today, or does not appear to be broken, except for possibly some simple condensed matter systems or complicated condensed matter systems, in the early universe, we could have been in a much different phase. And it's possible in the early universe, there was an era where rotational invariance was spontaneously broken. So when we think of the early universe, it sort of breaks up into two parts. Well, maybe more than two, depending on how coarse you want to be. But two distinct ones are the very early universe, the so-called inflationary era, where we had exponential expansion. Actually, it's not so different from today. But anyways, that's a different story. Where we had exponential expansion, and it was during that era that we solved the horizon, the flatness problems, that we generated the density perturbations, at least according to the current paradigm. And then later, we exited that era, entering an era of conventional Robertson-Walker expansion, radiation domination, then matter domination. And so the question we asked is, what if rotational invariance was spontaneously broken during the inflationary era? And then as we entered the inflationary era, we entered a phase where rotational invariance was spontaneously broken. And then as we exited it, the spontaneous breaking went away and we recovered rotational invariance. What signatures would that leave behind today? How could we know that that occurred? How can we put limits on that possible breaking of rotational invariance? Of course, we don't expect the breaking of rotational invariance, if it existed, to be an order one effect. Since the density perturbations were generated there, that should leave some order one violation of isotropy in the density perturbations, and that's not observed. So what we're going to ask is, what would be the effect of some small breaking of rotational invariance, spontaneous breaking of rotational invariance during the inflationary era? Now, I have to say from the outset that this is a subject that's really out there. What do I mean by really out there? A little bit loony. We don't have any evidence that this occurred, but we do have data. We do have observations of the universe, and if they're able to constrain this possibility, we should know what those constraints are. So that's the attitude I want to take. Not that this is a particularly likely possibility, but it is a possibility we can constrain, and so we should. It's not very interesting unless I can say something generic about it. So I'm going to start off not by looking at any models, but trying to just to characterize for you how one would expect a spontaneous violation of rotational invariance during the inflationary era to affect observables. That'll be about half of this little talk, and then the other half will be a particular inflationary model that realizes the general form that I'll present to you. So the remnants of the inflationary era that we observe are the density perturbations. So And I'll Fourier transform them. It's good to Fourier transform most things, especially when you have translational invariants. So this is delta rho over rho as a function of a wave number k. And usually, it's generated in inflation due to quantum fluctuations in the field. And so there's a two-point correlation. We characterize it in the following way, the two-point correlation. Probably delta star of q, but never mind. I'm going to write this as p of k, where k is the magnitude of the wave vector k, times a delta function of k minus q. Well, let's look at the various parts of this formula. It's not a big formula, so it's easy to take it apart. There's the delta function saying that modes of different wave number are uncoupled. Well, that's the reason why we Fourier transform. That's a consequence of translational invariants. Every time you have translational invariants, you'll have that property. Outside of this is some function of k, of the magnitude of the wave vector k. The reason it depends only on the magnitude is because of rotational invariants. If we didn't have rotational invariants, it could depend on the wave vector k itself, not just the magnitude of the wave vector k. So since we're going to examine the possibility of a breaking of rotational invariants, we're not going to change the delta function. We should focus on the so-called power spectrum, P. We're going to imagine that some vector... the spontaneous breaking of rotational invariants, or the breaking of rotational invariants, picks out a preferred direction characterized by a unit vector n. And to analyze the way it could enter in the formula, we'll use what's usually called a Spurion analysis in particle physics. Even though this is a fixed vector, if we assume that under rotations it rotates, then we should, in this way, where R is a rotation matrix, then we should write down invariants. So how could P of K depend on K? So now what's going to happen? I should say it like this. P of K, when I allow for breaking of rotational invariants, will go to a new thing, which will depend on the full vector K, but I have to make invariants constructed out of N and the wave vector k if I pretend that this thing transforms. Yes?
Maybe I missed something. Have you already assumed that this is spontaneous breaking by some field within a flat three geometry?
Well,
as opposed to rotational invariants breaking in the geometry itself?
Well, maybe I should be more precise. It's not going to occur in a flat space-time. It's going to happen in this...
What's the meaning of the Fourier transforming?
So it's flat now. Okay. This is the usual power spectrum analysis. Another way to say it would be when I go into the sitter space... Maybe this will make it clear. Then I'm going to have... So let's imagine n was along the third axis for the moment. Then I could have something like this. dx1 squared plus dx2 squared plus b of t squared dx3 squared. And then I would say that n points along the third direction, let's say, picking out a special direction there in terms of the coordinates x1, x2, x3. So I am assuming that the breaking of rotational invariants is characterized by a vector and not a tensor, for example. So what form could it have? Well, it'll have the usual piece. And I'm imagining that the breaking is small. And so if I have more powers of n, they'll give me a smaller effect. So I should expand in a power series in n, and keep the lead, just the leading term possible. That'll give me the leading effect. So there's a 1. I could have something linear in n dot k. Let me do a unit vector here with some other function f of k, perhaps. And then I could have something quadratic etc. Now I want to truncate to the leading term. I'm going to assume that the breaking of rotational invariants has a leaves unbroken a parity symmetry where k goes to minus k, and therefore this term does not occur. Why am I assuming this? Well, maybe I should tell you why I'm assuming this. I'm assuming this because when we tried to build explicit models, we always found that that was the case. And so I'm going to restrict my attention to that case. Although, you'll see from the analysis I do that it would be very easy to do this case if you wanted to instead of this one, but every model we could imagine seemed to give us this.
So all the more reason to measure the other one.
Well, the method I'm going to show you for this one here, you could just redo it for that one. It wouldn't be very hard. So
the second one gives you a CPT violation, right?
This one here?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's related to T violation. That's right. But unless I find a T violating operator.
You can conserve CPT and have this quadratic operator.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about CP, but T anyway seemed to be relevant.
No, CPT.
CPT?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. If you need CPT violation, that would really explain why we could never get it. Okay. Maybe you're right. That would explain. Okay, so we're going to focus on a term like this. We're going to stop here because these are supposed to be smaller than this if the violation of rotational invariance is a small quantity. Let me say a little bit more about this. In standard inflation, the power spectrum has a particular form, the so-called scale invariant spectrum. If I go to the primordial spectrum, that would be P of k going like 1 over k cubed. If you include the fact that modes come in the horizon and start growing in the matter-dominated era, it gets translated to the Harrison-Zeldovich spectrum, where P of k goes like k. And the fact that P of k is scale invariant really is a consequence of the fact that the Hubble constant is approximately constant during inflation. And our small violation of rotational invariance is going to leave the space-time still approximately de Sitter with an approximately single constant Hubble constant up to small deviations. And therefore, I expect the scale invariance to be preserved, not just for this term, but for this term. And that means that my g of k, if this overall factor goes like 1 over k cubed, my g of k should just be a constant g star. And now I really have a very predictive scenario. The violations of rotational invariance are characterized by 3 quantities. A single number g star that measures their strength, and 2 numbers that characterize a unit vector n, that tell you the direction associated with the spontaneous violation of rotational invariance. So given that it's so constrained, this form, and I've argued for this form just on very general arguments, not a particular model, I'm going to sketch how you would figure out how this change in the power spectrum affects something you could observe. For example, the example I'll do is the anisotropy of the microwave background. And I like to do this exercise because it's kind of relaxing. It's basically Clebsch-Gordan coefficients and a little bit of physics that I looked up in a book. The little bit of physics that I had to look up was astrophysics. I'm a particle physicist, so I'm not qualified to do that part. I'm going to come back. I'm going to look at an explicit inflationary model, and we'll see to what extent G star really is constant. It's not really constant. It has a logarithmic dependence on the wave number, a different one than in the standard inflation, but not totally unrelated, so I will come back to that later. For now, let's just make this assumption and let's play around with spherical harmonics. What could be more fun? Okay. So that's the general form. And now I want to talk about the anisotropy of the microwave background. One way to characterize it is to decompose so that the microwave background, the temperature, and let's see, what did I call it in my notes? Sorry. And we're looking at the fluctuations in the temperature, how they depend on the direction of the sky, E. So this is the fundamental quantity, delta T over the mean temperature in a particular direction. And what we're going to do is we're going to express it in terms of multiple moments, ALMs. So they're just the integrals over the direction of the unit vector E, YLM of E, delta T of E over T. And usually the things that you look at are correlations of the ALMs of this type. This expectation value outside of here, it's kind of a strange thing. So I won't talk about it. Somehow, you know, in the sense of the original quantum mechanics that you do in inflation, it has to do with an average over many universes. Of course, we're stuck in this universe. There's nothing we could do about it, so I don't really know what we're averaging over. But I'll keep the brackets there. It's comforting for me to keep the brackets there. Of course, really, you get to do some averaging by summing over different values of m within our single universe or single bubble. Okay. So these are the things that we're going to be after. These don't necessarily completely characterize the anisotropy of the microwave background. They do if this is a Gaussian variable, if it is a random variable. Usually there is some non-Gaussianity inflation, but it's very small. Okay, so here we go. Here's all the physics we got to put in. Then we just have to do Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. So I'm going to write the formula for delta T over T, how it depends on the primordial fluctuations delta. So the primordial fluctuations, they're generated during the inflationary era when we had this violation of rotational invariance. The inflationary era ends. All the physics is then is then rotationally invariant. There's no more violation of rotational invariance. So delta T over T is going to be linearly related to the primordial fluctuations because they're small. So this is just, this factor here is just, we just put it in for convenience. This, you don't have to put it in. There's a spherical harmonic. There's a, well, Legendre polynomial that depends on the direction between the wave vector k and the direction you look on the sky. There's the primordial fluctuation. And then there's a function that depends on the particular polynomial, L. And because the physics that turns the fluctuations, primordial fluctuations, into fluctuations of temperature is rotationally invariant, this is just a function of the magnitude of k. So this is the formula you look up in a book if you're a particle physicist. And once we have this formula, then we're cooking with gas, because we have the relation between delta T over T and this. And now we can just proceed and do a little bit of algebra to calculate the quantity we want here. So let me say a little bit more about this quantity. I'm going to write it in the following way. I'm going to write it as ALM sub naught. Sub naught means it's what you get when G is star is set equal to zero. It's the standard result from inflation or from rotational invariance. And then there's a new part, delta LM L prime M prime, that'll be proportional to G star. And I want to tell you a little bit about the form of this object. Not going to do too much algebra. So I want to go to ALMs, and so I want to be able to decompose this into YLMs that involve E and YLMs that involve K. There's a formula that does that for you. It's got a name. I forgot the name. It's in Jackson's book. So you just use that formula. This is the relaxing part of the talk. It's got a 4 pi over 2L plus 1. That's why I put this thing here. It's got a sum over minus L to L. And it's got YLM of E complex conjugate, YLM of K hat. And now you can see why this is so convenient, because now when I take ALM by doing this integral, I use the orthogonality of the YLMs. And I'll just be left with this one as a function of K. Is that clear? Okay. So I just do this integral. I could call this M prime and this L prime. Doing this integral will set L prime equal to L, M prime equal to M. The whole thing collapses down, and I get this pathetically simple formula. And now I just want to take this product of two of the A's. Well, that'll just be two integrals. What should I call the other one? How about Q? I'll get the two YLMs. I'll get the two theta L's. One L, L prime of Q. And then I'll get the two-point function. Now I'll just put in our formula for this. Our formula is P of K, 1 plus G star N dot K hat squared, times a delta function of K minus Q, and that collapses the integral to make it just an integral over Q. Or just integral over K. So maybe I should write down that integral. What do you think? I'll write it down. Oopsie, sorry. Okay, so that's our formula. Let's set G star equal to 0. Take a look. Oh, sorry. It's hard. I'm way over in the corner here in no man's land. Well, if G star is equal to 0, then I can do the integration over the over the directions of K. One of these should be a YLM star somewhere. We'll put it here. It doesn't matter. Then I'll be able to use, then there's nothing here that depends on the direction of K. I'll use the orthogonality. I'll get something that goes like delta LL prime, delta MM prime, times an integral, where L is equal to L prime of the theta squared. That's the standard inflationary result for what you expect for the expectations of the multiple moments. So the reason I wrote this out is just so we can see how it changes when we have the violation of rotational invariance. How is it going to change? So let's focus now on the part delta. The part delta doesn't come from the 1. It comes from this part that goes like G star. And this is n divided into the unit vector k squared. And so you can express that in terms of spherical harmonics, the way you can express the Cartesian coordinates in terms of spherical harmonics. And I'll tell you what you get.
This will go all the way back to here just to drive you totally nuts.
So what you do is you introduce spherical components for the unit vector for the direction n. So n plus is what everyone else calls n minus. And n minus is what everyone else calls n plus. And n zero is nz. And then if you do that, n dot k squared is just equal to 4 pi over 3. M plus y 1 1 of k hat plus m minus 1 minus 1 of k hat plus n 0 y 1 0 of k hat all squared. So this factor here goes in here, and now you have an integral over 4 y's. But you could take the product of two y's and write it in terms of a single y with coefficients, the Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. And so you can eventually write this as an integral of over two y's and use the orthogonality of the YLMs. But what happens? We can understand what happens in a simple way. No longer are we forced to have L prime equal to M, or L prime equal to L and M prime equal to M. For example, L and L, there'll be contributions, there will be contributions where L is equal to L prime, and they'll change from the standard ones. For example, they'll depend on M now. But there'll also be contributions where these differ by 2. Because basically we're inserting, if you want to talk particle physics lingo, we're inserting a spin 2 perturbation inside of here, and then we're adding up all the angular momentum to add up to 0. So that's the real difference that you'd expect. People have discussed in the literature violations of rotational invariance before and how you might try to see them in the microwave background. And it was one thing that was proposed in the astrophysics literature was something called the bispectrum. I'll tell you what the bispectrum is. They take these products here, then they multiply by some Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. They sum over M and M prime to make some object. What should I call the object? I'll call it B. That depends on some total angular momentum you make from L and L prime and some total M that you make from M and M prime. And this physics that I discussed would correspond to the possibility of getting L equals 2, but no higher L. Don't worry about it. It's just fine to analyze it this way. You don't have to introduce the bispectrum. Just for those of you that know about that piece of literature. Okay. Let me write down one formula that's kind of compact, just so you can get a sense of things. Let's say I decided to look at this delta L, M, L prime, M prime. In the case where L is equal to L prime, and M is equal to M prime. So remember, in that case, a simplification occurs. When L is equal to M prime, when L is equal to L prime, you end up with the same integral over K as you got in the usual inflationary case. You have theta L squared. And so if I divide out by the usual inflationary answer, everything cancels out, except for the stuff that involves these new Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. So it's a very compact answer. And I'll show you that just so you can get a sense of how things look. Whoa, black shirt. It's kind of bad, isn't it? Oh, well. I'll look nerdy when I go to the airport.
You said you erased that formula completely. You said you got out of the book. The theta there, did I understand right that that's what carries you from the end of inflation up to the CMB.
Right.
So why does it depend on L?
Well, I mean, it depends on the, why does it depend on L? Yeah, well, L equals 1 is a little bit different than, you get all these functions of, I actually derived it once. I don't have a simple way of saying it. Let's see if I can... Well, for example, if you have a scattering cross-section, it could be different depending on the angular momentum that the photons have, what partial wave they scatter in. And you also just get these spheric, it involves these JLs of KR, some integrals when you do that. Yeah, I'd have to look back. I don't have a simple explanation for you.
Okay.
Sorry. We could do it after the talk. I'm sure I could. I thought a little about figure it out. Part of it is related to scattering. But there's part that's not really scattered. There's a part that's just standard Sachs-Wolf, and it also has the dependence on L. So where am I? Okay. So let me write down this formula for you. Yeah, I'm sure if we wrote down the standard Sachs-Wolf formula and massage it a bit, you do get this dependence on L. Okay. Yeah, I kind of remember now. So what happens is you have sort of an e to the I k dot the direction, and then you expand this in the spherical harmonics, and the coefficients the PLs and the coefficients depend on L, and you have some integrals that give you results that depend on L when you write out the Sachs-Wolf formula. So that's part of the dependence on L. Okay. So we're going to take this, divide up by this. And what do you get? Well, it's all proportional to G star. Oh, I forgot to say something. So now we have this direction vector n on the sky. Let me just write down polar coordinates for the direction of n. So the microwave background, when you do this decomposition with respect to the ALMs, you've picked out some coordinate system. And this unit vector n doesn't have to be aligned with the z-axis of that coordinate system. So let's just call the angle theta star between its direction and the z-axis of the coordinate system chosen to analyze the microwave background. Simple formula. You might think there's something magical about cos squared theta star equals a third, that this term cancels out. But if we looked at the other things where, so this is when they're equal. If we looked at the other things where L is not equal to L prime, they don't cancel out at that special angle. So there's nothing really magical about that angle. You'll see that it's got this dependence on M, which of course couldn't happen unless you had a violation of rotational invariance. And it's proportional to the strength G star. Okay, so this provides enough information for someone that's more adept with the data to extract from the data some limit on G star as a function of the direction on the sky of the unit vector n, or to discover that you get a better fit for a particular direction and a particular value of G star. Of course, you'll always get a better fit, but it might not be statistically significant, and then you translate it into a limit because you've got more parameters. Well, I pushed you into a particular form for how the violation of rotational invariance influenced the power spectrum. So now I want to try to motivate that form a little more. Well, I argued in general, I just want to try to build an explicit model and see if it realizes that. Maybe there was some subtlety and my general arguments were false. Should really always try to do that. Unfortunately, I have to explain to you a little bit of what might be called particle physics notation. So there's something that particle physicists typically call a model. There's something that they call a scenario. And then there's other stuff. When we got a model, we can really calculate more or less everything. When we got a scenario, we can calculate some things kind of okay. Then there's this large class of other types of things we do, which are on the sleazy side. But I think what I'm going to do is not really a model. It really fits more into scenario, or maybe somewhere between scenario and other stuff. And the reason why is because I'm not going to put in any dynamics that causes the spontaneous violation to occur or causes it to turn off. Rather, I'm just going to work in the inflationary era, stick it in by hand, in a way I'll show you, and then work out the consequences. Obviously, we try to build a model and not just a scenario. And obviously, since I'm not presenting it to you, we failed. That might mean that there's some kind of theorem that says that this can't happen. I don't know. It would be interesting if you could show such a thing. There is one theorem called the cosmic no-hair theorem that does bear on this. I'll bring this up a little bit later. But unfortunately, I don't have a complete model. I'm just going to put in the preferred direction by hand, and then at the end of inflation, assume it goes away. So what are we going to do? I'm not going to work on all the steps here. I'll just sketch it out for you. But I'll tell you all the things you need to be able to do it yourself. Okay, so we're done with the microwave background, and I guess I'll go over here, and we're on to a model during the inflationary era. There's lots of ways to generate density perturbations from inflation. There's the standard model, the standard case where it's fluctuations in the inflaton field that generates them. There's the so-called DGZK mechanism, where it's fluctuations in another massless scalar field during inflation that eventually turns into the density perturbations. Because it's simpler to analyze, I'm going to do the second case. What I'm going to do is put in this violation of rotational invariance, add a free massless scalar field, and calculate its two-point function, and see if the Fourier transform has the form that I suggested. So let me tell you the dynamics. We need the dynamics. So I'm going to have an action. Well, it's general relativity, so we got to have R. Curvature scalar. The inflaton provides a vacuum energy that causes the exponential expansion. Of course, slowly the inflaton evolves, slowly but surely, and eventually reaches the end of the slow roll era, and then it starts to rock rapidly. We reheat the universe. Forget about that. Treat the slow roll era as really slow, just add a constant. That's all my inflaton dynamics, the vacuum energy, rho. We need a four vector that picks out a particular direction to break rotational invariance, a spatial direction in this case. We'll call that four vector U, We'll give it a Lagrangian. Then we'll pick out the direction. L sub u, density. Then we have our free massless scalar field, chi, and it's Lagrangian. So I got to tell you L u and L chi. Okay. L chi, well, L chi is a free massless scalar field. That we know, chi. It's, dang, pretty tough, you know. Working with a real professional relativist, I had to flip the sign of my metric. Anything could happen for the rest of this lecture now, but you know, what can you do? LU. Okay, here we go. So LU's got a bunch of kinetic terms, but then it's got a lambda. Don't worry, I won't bore you with tremendous details here, but I have to write a few equations to sketch the physics. So this lambda will just be treated like a Lagrange multiplier. It'll force this U to have a magnitude set by m squared, so it'll just pick up some, it'll pick out some direction and have a magnitude m. And this is the invariant, general relativistic invariant product of the two. So I'm forcing the spontaneous breaking of rotational variance by putting this in with a Lagrange multiplier. This is not real dynamics. This is why it's not a real model. And then, but then I'm going to have some kinetic terms. And there's other ways to contract the indices. Let me not write them all down. We put them all in, but just to save a little bit of space. There's just all the various different ways you can contract the indices. One way of adding these terms makes it look like you constructed a field strength tensor out of U and squared it up. And then there's other possibilities as well.
What was the problem with just squaring the thing that's
well, you don't have to square it.
The whole thing in frequency, rather than doing it with a Lagrange multiplier, doing it
with a potential?
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah, wouldn't that make it a model?
Well, if it sat at the bottom of a potential, it would, yeah. Yeah, you know, but the only thing we actually tried was to write this as derivatives of scalar fields and do stuff. We didn't really play with real four vectors.
Nothing in that potential picks out a direction. It just picks out a magnitude.
Yeah, so it's good. It's like spontaneous symmetry breaking. I'll just pick it along some direction and solve, and then it inflates and it. So. Yeah, maybe it's possible. We weren't introducing a fundamental four vector, but I guess we could, and we could make it a field strength tensor here. Thanks. I'll think about it. Maybe it's not so hard to build a model.
People have done this a lot with symmetry breaking that gives you a time mark.
Right. Well, the time-like case, they usually also analyze with the Lagrange multiplier. One of my collaborators wrote probably the classic paper on that subject. Okay, so as was mentioned, I mean, U is going to just pick out some direction to satisfy this constraint, and so I'll line it up with the z-axis. It doesn't really have to be the z-axis, that's just we can always put back in n at the end of the calculation. So I lined it up, we lined it up. So what do we got? We got u0 equals 0. I'm giving you the background now. Ux equals Uy equals 0. I have to tell you a little bit more. The metric has this form, minus dt squared plus a of t squared dx perp squared plus b of t squared dz squared. And then uz is just m over b of t. Because of the metric that contracts the indices here. So we put this as an we derived the field equations, including gravity and this field. We put this in as an ansatz, this form for the metric, and we solved Einstein's equations, and we found A of t and B of t. Okay. A few pages of algebra pass. What do you get? Well, you get A of t is e to the h a t. B of t is equal to e to the h b t, where h a and h b are constants, and they're defined by h a is a dot over a, h b is b dot over b, and they're not quite equal. H a is h b, 1 plus 16 pi g beta 1 m squared. So HA and HB, those Hubble constants, they mostly come from rho of lambda. And then they have a small difference, which comes from the breaking of rotational invariants by the existence of this preferred direction picked out by the vector. Now, this is a little bit surprising, and it's because of this so-called cosmic no-hair theorem. And the cosmic no-hair theorem says, if you have a cosmological constant, and then you put some other matter in the space, if the matter in the space satisfies the strong and dominant energy conditions, the space-time will quickly evolve to ordinary de Sitter space. No different evolution for the two different directions. But so obviously we're violated something in the theorem. So two possibilities: the theorem's not really a theorem. So then I'd have to look at the proof. That would be a disaster. You made an algebra mistake. There's three of us. Small chance. Or you violated some of the conditions for the theorem. And indeed, if you calculate the stress tensor following from LU. It ends up that it does violate the strong energy condition and the dominant energy condition. In other words, if you calculate the stress tensor, T mu nu, and dot it into, you can find time-like vectors, T mu and T nu, for which that's negative. So I don't know whether that says anything deep, whether that makes it less likely that this is realistic. It's just true. So that's sometimes called the cosmic no-hair theorem. That might have been a reason why you wouldn't start this project. You would think that because of the exponential expansion, because of the cosmological constant, you would smooth out this potential anisotropy. But it doesn't happen that way. You can see what characterizes the strength. It's characterized by this little m squared divided by m Planck squared. That's what sets the difference of the Hubble constants.
Right now you're just solving for the background during inflation.
That's correct.
You've got the set.
What I'm going to calculate is the two-point correlation with pi. This other field that leads to the density perturbations in quantum mechanics.
So Mark, I'm still a little, so there's no interaction between pi and u except through the metric.
I'm going to put one in later. For example, we could have there's nothing in here. I could have easily added this. I'll talk about it now since you brought it up. It's a very good point, actually. I was going to put it in later. I could have added this term.
Right.
And this would go with some m squared down here. And I think it's really important to understand that this term could be there, because I think it's very likely, if this effect existed, that this would actually be the dominant term. Because, you know, in order to get a significant effect here, if this is what's dominating the physics, you really need little m to be of order m Planck. Not of order m Planck. It could be a tenth of m Planck, but then that would give you a 1% effect, but it couldn't be tiny compared to m Planck. And then the dynamics of inflation has to be significantly less than m Planck, otherwise you get too much gravitational waves. So it's hard to see how the dynamics of the inflaton could turn it on and off and still get a significant effect if this was what was dominating things. But as you pointed out, you could also have something like this where m is not as big as m Planck. So this case ends up being very simple to analyze. So it could be a situation where this is totally negligible. M, this capital M is quite a bit less than M Planck, then the space would be essentially exactly the sitter up to negligible differences. This would dominate. It ends up that G star is exactly a constant in that case. It's very simple to analyze because you're just basically dotting it into the case here. It comes out, if you Fourier transform it, it comes out exactly in the form I talked about. The case that's more non-trivial to analyze and where G star does develop some logarithmic dependence is the case where it comes from the change in the space-time. But
so that term calls an anisotropy with A equal to B.
That's right. Because this would only have it only exist in the third direction, and it would correspond exactly, almost trivially, to G star equal a constant. You would just Fourier transform this. Write this wave equation in k-space, and you would just see it. So that's a very simple analysis. And that was the one we originally did, and then we got nervous. Because we figured, well, maybe we better understand this other possibility. And this other possibility, in some sense, is less likely to be important for the reason I mentioned, and it's a lot... Well, it's just that in order for this to be a significant effect, this little m has to be... It's smaller than M Planck, but it can't be a lot smaller. And if it's not a lot smaller, it's hard to see how the dynamics of the inflaton somehow could turn it on and off, because that dynamics is quite a bit smaller. So there's no theorem there. But this is the much more non-trivial case. And if nothing goes wrong in this case, then we figured it was Miller time after that. So let's analyze the harder case. If that works, we're not in any trouble. It's kind of an elegant calculation. You have to be a physicist or an astrophysicist to consider a calculation elegant. So I'll tell you how we did it. I'll just sketch it. I won't run over it too much. Don't worry. I won't run over it all. I'll just sketch what we did. So what happens is that you start inflation at time t equals 0. We'll pick A of 0 equals B of 0 equals 1. At that time, this vector turns on. The Hubble constants are a little bit different. We want, at the end of inflation, A of t and B of t to still be approximately equal. Otherwise, we'd have a big violation of rotational invariance. And so what you need, there's a small parameter, which is basically the difference in the Hubble constants, divided by some average Hubble constant, we could define h bar is equal to a third, the two directions that go like ha plus the one direction that goes like hb. And in our paper, we put a two-thirds in here. It's not important. This quantity we need to be small, but actually we need the number of e-foldings times epsilon h to be small. So that's what we'll assume. And then what we did is the following. I want to calculate this two-point correlation.
Sorry, let me just... Is this about initial conditions giving up the pre-inflation?
This part's the fact that...
So you're assuming no breaking before inflation.
Right.
So it turns on with inflation.
Turns on with inflation and turns off with inflation.
And this is some... Is it some attractor that locks into the epsilon function?
No, epsilon just measures the strength of the violation of rotational invariance, how it affects the metric. But because it occurs in the exponentials, for these A and B to end up close to each other, you actually need the number of e-foldings times epsilon to be small. So epsilon.
Yeah. You're just trying to keep it small.
Yeah, just trying to keep the effects small. Okay, so what do you do? Well, we have a small parameter, and we calculated the effects in perturbation theory in epsilon h. How did we do it? We introduced a background space-time characterized by h bar. That was our background metric. And then we wrote our Lagrangian here in terms of this background space-time. I'm sorry, it's the fluctuations in chi that I'm interested in. So we wrote the Lagrangian for chi in terms of a background space-time g-bar, plus what we call the perturbation. In other words, we decompose the metric into this background plus something else. And the something else was the perturbation. We went to conformal time, where these exponentials become times to a power. You write them as e to the log of the conformal time, and you expand it out, and the coefficient ends up, in the calculation we do, ends up going like the difference between HA and HB, because everything's coming from the perturbation. So we just did, I want to calculate this quantum mechanical correlator. This is quadratic in the field chi. It's free field theory. It doesn't matter that this thing depends on time. It's still just free field theory. Quantum mechanics of harmonic oscillators, perturbed. And so you can just do that calculation completely straightforwardly. There's no subtlety if you have the strength. That's the great thing about perturbation theory. If you can set it up in terms of perturbation theory, you will succeed to get the answer. That's why people use perturbation theory even when the expansion parameter is not small, because they know they will succeed. They'll at least get something to look at, give you some intuition. So I won't go through the details because I'm running a little bit late. It really is straightforward. It's quantum field theory, but it's free field theory. You don't have to think about it as being in a curved space-time or anything like that. It's just a time-dependent Hamiltonian, but it's still time-dependent free field theory. So I'll just tell you the answer then. I'm skipping some stuff. So you calculate this correlator. You find the following. There's one little tricky point. You get a log of the wave number over h bar. But then when we're done with inflation, you know, when an astronomer tells you what the power spectrum is, they Fourier transformed, they picked out some coordinates for their coordinate system. They don't have the coefficient in front of z twice the coefficient in front of x or anything like that. They could. That would just be a change of coordinate system. But of course they use a system where they have, you know, manifest rotational invariance where it does, they don't. And so we end up at the end of inflation with A different than B. Then all this stuff turns off. So we should shift our coordinates so that those scale factors end up the same and then evolve together. And that adds another little thing here, which is minus the number of E foldings. So you can use the fact that this thing is the log of sort of the average scale factor at the end of inflation, and you can mush around the formula. I'll mush it around for you. And Q of T here is just the physical wave vector. It's K over A at the end of inflation. So you get this log. And this calculation was done treating the log as if it was large and neglecting the constant pieces, so it's not the whole answer. I used perturbation theory and then I made additional approximation. Well, I realize I did that part too fast because I didn't want to keep you here too long. But you end up with this log. And the log comes basically from the fact that you get sort of a residual time dependence from the fact that these things don't evolve with the same rate. When you do the perturbation theory, you end up with a non-zero coefficient times a log of the conformal time. And that's what ends up generating this log here. If you look at it in detail, because because the measurements of the microwave background go over about three orders of magnitude in the wave vector Q, and you need at least 60, there's about 60 E foldings from when those things cross to the end of inflation, you're talking about the log varying by it. The log is about 60, and it's varying by about 6. So there's a 10% variation in G star from this. But remember,
can you define Q once more? You said the words.
Yeah. Q is K, the co-moving wave number, over A at the end of inflation, the scale factor. Remember, they're approximately equal, so it doesn't matter which one I put here, because I'm throwing away the constants that don't have a log. But if you say that this is the dominant source of the physics, this gives you something that has no log, that's exactly constant. So that's the end of the story. Let me just recap what we've shown. So we explored the possibility that during inflation, there was some spontaneous breaking of rotational invariance. We found that by very general arguments, we could characterize the form that that would take in the power spectrum. And given that form, it was pretty simple to analyze how it would affect the microwave background. If you're more interested in galaxy correlations, you could have, assuming that the galaxies are somehow related to delta rho over rho, if you know that relation, then you can calculate the impact on galaxy correlations or dark matter correlations if you want. In this lecture, I focused on the microwave background. Then we looked at an explicit inflationary scenario, and we showed by explicit calculation that it realized the particular form that we argued by general argument such a violation would take. And so that strengthens those arguments, that you have an explicit calculation that realizes the results of those general arguments. Thank you. Yeah, well, I found one paper, the one paper that talked about this bispectrum that I mentioned, that claimed to have done something, but I really couldn't understand what those limits translated to in terms of G star. When I made a first pass, it looked like all it said was G star was less than 1. But I'm convinced that wasn't the optimal analysis. So it needs someone that's better equipped to handle the data to do that analysis than I am.
So my recollection is that when you try to transition between different behaviors of the background spacetime, if you do it in a clumsy way, you can screw up the perturbation thing.
Oh, sure. That happened with the original density perturbation.
And so can you sort of tell a little bit about how you... And you're kind of doing this by hand, and how you turn it off, and how confident are you that it's being turned off in a sort of physical enough way that you're not introducing artifacts and
well,
that kind of thing?
Yeah, some change in the equation of state that would cause
something to
grow.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because we don't have a real...
Yeah, the right way. You don't have a right way to compare it with, I guess.
Yeah. Well, maybe I should go back and think about this squared, and I might have a right way.
Yeah.
I need that to answer
your
question better.
Yeah.
Any other questions I can't answer?
So back to the very beginning, you threw away the linear term, but so the breaking rotation variance I would expect would be from known vector fields like photons. I mean, in a plasma, you can have some region of space in which the magnetic field is essentially frozen in, right? So it seems to me that, I mean, this approach wouldn't be how you do that. I mean, you wouldn't have to write a Lagrangian down for that because you'd have a true background field there. So I guess what I'm saying is, at the time inflation was occurring, there were true background fields that could have had an expectation value.
No, you would do it like this because... I mean, E and B, they would still gravitate those fields, so they would affect the expansion of the universe, and you could, maybe you'd have the real dynamics that froze them as opposed, but if you were just freezing them, you would do it in some analysis like this. They gravitate, right? They have energy, they gravitate.
Well, so I'm just arguing that perhaps once you leave in the linear term, that would be dominant.
Well, why would that be dominant? I mean, I could make this an F mu nu squared, by the correct coefficients here, and then, this is not really a B. This is the four-vector potential itself having an expectation value. A little bit different. I haven't tried to analyze that case. And we have no idea what the degrees of freedom were during inflation, right? I mean, a long time ago.
Sorry, I'm
just going to know what info.
Can you justify why, if it's truly a background magnetic field, why you would throw away the linear term?
I don't really know in the case of a background field. I mean, it would... So what do you want me to do here? So it, the background field is like well, it's I don't know.
I guess you could characterize it in terms of the A mu still.
Yeah, I mean, you could write the whole standard model of Lagrangian and just replace all the A mu's with this vector.
Yeah. But it wouldn't be a constant the way this is.
Well, so I'm approximating that there's some region of space in which it is constant.
Well, okay. If the four vector potential is constant, so it's not B, which is curl A, then this is the right analysis.
So it, you mentioned that you've covered primarily the microwave background, but also hinted that there are other physical,
because
physical effects. And you, by introducing a spin to variant, you can get things like shear as well as a difference in Hubble constant. I'm thinking that one could sort of pursue a phenomenological. Phenomenological model where you don't have to have your actual model, you just, like you did, introduce it by hand and see what all of the various different predictions are for these observables and see if the ratios make sense.
Well, the things we observe today, they all come from this power spectrum, P, right? They, apart from the gravitational waves, which we haven't observed, but maybe we will. So once I characterize how it occurs in the power spectrum, then I can go ahead and calculate anything I want. Terms of what we observed today. Once I cut, because they all follow from the primordial power spectrum plus the known evolution, galaxy correlations, lensing, microwave background. They're all going to come from that P prime of K. The second part was just a particular model that tried to realize that form.
I'm thinking that if you break rotational invariance, that you also introduce something else.
Well, it's all during the inflationary era, not today. So all that's left over is the primordial power spectrum.
But that's still in the horizon.
Well, it's outside the horizon, and then the horizon catches up to it, and the wavelengths come into the horizon, and we see, and then they start to grow if it's the matter-dominated era. But they're set by this primordial physics and the subsequent evolution. It, I've assumed, is rotationally invariant. You could try to, change that, but that was the assumption that this strange violation of rotational invariance occurred during this strange era that we know very little about.
Is there any relationship? I mean, if you have non-commuting coordinates back in those early times, then of course there's preferred direction. By that commutator, does that lead to a linear term first of all, such as Bob was asking, or would it fall within this framework?
Well, the correct answer is I don't know. That might be a case where you could actually analyze it. Assume it's not a bad idea actually. Assume that the thetas arose from some dynamics and then they disappear after inflation, and try to calculate things during inflation and anti-commuting. That seems like an interesting project. Yeah, I don't, let's see, theta, so it's like, it's anti-symmetric, right?
Yeah.
So it's really it's anti-symmetric. And so if it was theta ij, then as far as space is concerned, you could contract it with an epsilon, so it still would just have one. You could view it as just having one index, like I did. So I'm not sure whether you'd get a linear term or whether it would fall into the class that I looked at, but it sounds like something you could look at. I haven't done that. Maybe I will. Thank you. I'm already pretty far out there with my rotational invariance. Now, once I have anti-commuting space-time, I'm sort of one further step.